Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Spotlight on Youth, a radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. My name is Lauren Litton, and I am the host of the show. The show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking our guests questions live on air by dialing 347-994-1149. That's 347-994-1149. Press the number 1 on your telephone keypad to indicate you have a question, and you will be placed in the queue. Also, feel free to log into the chat room and pose a question there. Joining us today is Patricia Campy, Director of the National Center for Juvenile Justice, also known as NCJJ. She has been the director since August 2008. Prior to joining NCJJ, Dr. Campy was the executive director of LaCroix and Milligan Associates, an evaluation and research firm that specialized in developing and evaluating the Healthy Families Child Abuse and Neglect Prevention and Intervention Program. She has also directed the PEMA Prevention Partnerships Research Evaluation and Planning Department, was an adjunct professor at the University of Arizona, where she taught classes on crime and public policy, research methods, and program evaluation, and she served on the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Blue Ribbon Panel. That panel was convened by the National Registry of Evidence-Based Programs and Practices to design a review system for determining the effectiveness of youth substance abuse programs at the community level. Additionally, Dr. Campy has conducted community development and crime prevention studies for the U.S. Department of Justice's Weed and Seed Initiative. Welcome, Trish, to Spotlight on Youth. Perhaps you can start by informing our listeners about NCJJ.
Okay, great. Well, thanks. It's a pleasure to be on the show today. NCJJ has been in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania since 1973. We're the research division of the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges, NCJFCJ, which is actually located in Reno, Nevada. And we're an integral piece of the NCJFCJ organization, but we also have an independent research function, which we felt was very important when working as part of a judges organization. And our founders back in 1973 were led by now federal U.S. District Court Judge Maurice B. Cohill, Jr., who's here in Pittsburgh. And our charter actually required that we maintain a separate office in a separate city, just so there isn't any appearance of the research not being independent. The reason we were born, if you will, because NCJFCJ is much older than us, the National Council's been around since 1937. We were formed in 73 because the judges had been doing trainings and had all these innovative ideas working with kids, and they looked around the table and said, well, how do we know any of this works? You know, is this just make us feel good, or is there some kind of research that we could do to demonstrate the effectiveness of our work? And of that conversation, the idea for a National Center on Juvenile Justice was born, and we're the only organization of our kind in the country that specifically focuses on juvenile justice research.
Great. Well, we have a multitude of reasons for wanting you as a guest on Spotlight on Youth, so we're excited as well to have you. But one of those reasons is that NCJJ recently issued a position statement about A&E's decision to fund and broadcast the show Beyond Scared Straight, which I believe is one of their highest-rated, if not their highest-rated shows. And that position statement has received a lot of attention. Can you give some background about why NCJJ decided to take a position and what is that position?
Well, being at the National Center, I mean, we have a responsibility to provide leadership to the nation, to the public, to practitioners in the field, and to funders and policymakers to really translate the research into meaningful discourse about how do we effectively solve the problems of juvenile crime and how do we prevent some of these problems in the first place. So we're always on the lookout for promising practices that come out, but we're also on the lookout for practices that are potentially harmful and cost maybe not as much money as effective practice, but actually can lead to some bad outcomes. And when things like Scared Straight come up, we immediately take notice and try and get the word out that this really isn't a good idea. Scared Straight, it's not a new idea. This was first introduced in the 1970s by Professor Finkenauer in New Jersey. And back in those days, he actually sent some kids from New Jersey to Rahway State Prison. And the theory was that if you put these kids into a situation with these criminals in a prison setting, you would scare the kids so much that they would not want to commit crimes, and therein lies the name, Scared Straight. But what the research showed out of those studies in the 1970s that not only did it not keep kids from getting into trouble, it actually led to more kids in the study group getting into trouble than kids who had not experienced that traumatic event. And so here we are, you know, 30-odd years later with Arts and Entertainment Channel putting together Beyond Scared Straight, and we just could not sit by silently and let this be passed by or passed on as an effective strategy when we know through the decades of research that it simply does not work.
And I've heard very similar things about like boot camps and other types of programs.
Right.
Are there other sort of efforts that you'd put into the same category as ineffective and maybe harmful?
There are. I mean, boot camps would certainly be one of those situations. For folks that aren't that familiar with boot camps, I mean, the name is similar to what they are like. They're based on a military-style structured setting where delinquent youth, serious delinquents, non-serious delinquents. So these could be even kids who are chronic truants or are arrested for underage drinking, which is what we call status offenses. Those are offenses that aren't illegal as a behavior unless you're underage. So if you're underage and you're caught drinking a beer, you could be arrested and you could potentially go to a boot camp. The boot camp environment, it's like a training school, if you will, where you send the kids there, they stay there, they sleep there for a certain period of time, anywhere from a few weeks to a few months. And it's a very disciplined environment in which the kids are told when to get up, when to go to sleep, you know, what to wear, what to eat, what to do. It's very much like a military boot camp. And the studies that have come out about those situations say that if you have a structured environment where kids are getting education and structure around daily living skills, you know, being responsible citizens, doing their homework, doing their chores, and all of that's done in a nurturing environment, like a family environment, where the child gets the message that you're teaching me this because you care about me. You're not teaching me this because you're going to beat me if I don't do it. If you're in that nurturing environment, the results are good. If you're in a boot camp environment where the staff don't have a relationship with the child and the staff aren't necessarily trained in a way that responds to misbehavior in an appropriate way, then you have escalations of problems like staff, you know, physically restraining kids that refuse to obey the boot camp demands and then kids running from boot camp. So boot camps are also in that category of a program intervention that, in the best case scenario, nothing changes about the child's behavior that you want to change. And in the worst case scenario, I mean, there have been kids who have not come out of boot camps, who have passed away from incidents that have happened there. So we would not recommend those either.
Okay. So, and I guess just touching base back again on the position on Scared Straight, I saw that change.org has taken up the cause and created a sign-on petition to send A&E. What have been other results of this public call for action?
Well, actually, I mean, they're not they haven't ordered any new episodes, which we see as a major victory. So the original episodes that they purchased were all the episodes that were purchased. And so aside from them running reruns over and over, it doesn't look like they're going to be doing any new shows. Two of the sites actually completely pulled out and refused to let A&E back in. And those sites, unfortunately, had already signed paperwork that allows A&E to continue showing the episode from their state, but the states themselves, Maryland and California, decided to suspend the Scared Straight programs. The only other state featured is South Carolina, and their corrections chief is against it, has come out and said that they're against it, and again, they will not be allowing the show to do any new sessions there. So I think the public pressure or the professional pressure has paid off. If you look on the internet at the blogging and you kind of tune into what the parents are saying, the thing you find is the parents are still really looking for something. I mean, they were attracted to this show because, I mean, some people were attracted for entertainment value, whatever that means, but other people were attracted because they really do have kids that they don't know what to do with. And so what needs to happen now is not just pull the rug out from under these kids and say, well, no, you can't send them to Scared Straight, but is to fill that gap with good information about what parents can do to effectively deal with the problems they're having with these kids.
Well, I think that's a perfect segue into sort of talking about what has demonstrated to work. I know, though, if you can just take a moment first, because just even from your bio, you have such significant experience in research to really explain to our audience what evidence-based means and why it's important to have that information, and then we can kind of move into what does work, okay?
Sure. Well, evidence-based programming is kind of a buzzword right now in the social sciences, and simply put, it means that if you have a program, whether it's a program working with young people or a program getting adults to stop smoking, you have to be collecting evidence, which is information. Evidence is information. You have to be collecting information throughout the course of that program so that by the time the person's done the program, you have something other than their opinion or your opinion to say, you know what, I think the difference between this person stopping smoking and not was our program. You've got to collect that evidence. You have to, in the case of kids in delinquency, you have to look at their arrest data. Did they reoffend? You have to talk to the kids. Was there any things you did during the program that you could have been arrested for that we didn't know about? And most kids are very honest with you. You need to talk to parents. You need to do what we call psychometric testing, which is some surveys that really can get into how the kid is feeling, what they're thinking, what they believe. And you have to actually do that work in order to say at the end of the program that the program is the reason why the kid's different, not something that was outside the program's control, such as the kid just growing up a little bit or having a parent come back into their life or other things that could influence that child that your program didn't have any control over.
Great. So what do we know? You were talking about filling in those gaps, and some of that's on the prevention side of things. So maybe you can talk about prevention and intervention. What is promising practice? What's been demonstrated to work?
Right. Absolutely. Well, I mean, there's quite a few programs out there that have demonstrated effectiveness, but there really is a range or a continuum of effectiveness that you can talk about. So there are some programs that have been shown to be effective with just a small handful of kids, basically. One of those might be something like Nurse Family Partnership, which is a prevention program, crime reduction, that works with moms and kids, vulnerable families, to try and prevent some of the early delinquency that we know through the research is more likely to lead to later delinquency. Some of those studies have only been done, though, in a few communities. And so while that type of a program might be very effective in a place like Buffalo, it might not be effective in a place like Phoenix or Pittsburgh or Los Angeles. there's other programs like multidimensional treatment and foster care, which is something used with kids in a foster care setting, in a group home setting, that have shown to be effective across a wide number of communities across the United States with different types of kids, you know, different genders, different age groups, different ethnicities, races. And so on the continuum, you kind of get this range of programs like the Nurse Family Partnership. At the one end, it's effective, but only with a few groups that it's been tested with, all the way up to something like multidimensional treatment and foster care, which shows wide effectiveness across the board. And there's a whole list of programs like that that kind of are on that scale of we're effective in this community all the way up to we've been effective in communities throughout the country. And you really can start to associate a cost to these programs. You can look at how much does it cost to train a program person to have a place to do the program and to get the kid into the program versus putting that same kid into a detention center or into a foster home or into a juvenile correctional facility. And one of the great resources that's out there for people is in the Washington State Institute for Public Policy, and they have a website that you can go to where it lists all of the different programs, where they have been effective, how many studies have been done about each program so you can see where they fit on that continuum I was talking about, and then what the benefits would be to a community, to taxpayers, kind of the cost idea. Because that's really, in today's economy, Lauren, with, you know, nobody has enough money and everyone's cutting back, it's very tempting to think, scared straight, it doesn't cost anything. Take the kid to prison one day, scare him and bring him home. It's cheap. But the thing is, you get what you pay for. And so this Washington State Institute for Public Policy website can really give people good, solid information about not only the evidence-based programs, but how much is it going to cost me and how does that compare to me putting a kid in detention or prison. Generally speaking, the evidence-based programs are much less expensive and they're much more effective increasing public safety and improving youth outcomes.
Great. And for our listeners who are interested, their website is wsipp.wa.gov.
Thank you.
One of the things you and I both said we want to concentrate on today is sort of effective reform efforts on the state and system level, and many mm-hmm. states are looking at this, Ohio being one of them. So maybe
sure.
you can let us know, what are some of the trends and strategies that are being explored right now?
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of the trends and strategies that are being explored hinge on a couple of key things, one of which is evidence-based risk and assessment screening. And what that means in a nutshell is that, you know, for years and years and years, kids would walk through the door of the juvenile court and just kind of arrive there with really nothing except the charge from the police that brought them there or an angry parent or a school that had disciplined the child. But there really wasn't information about who is this child, what are their issues, where do they come from, what's their family like, do they know how to read, are they on medication? You know, let's get a picture of this child. And like a common sense answer would tell you, the more you know about a person and what their needs are, the better able you are to respond to their needs in a way that's actually going to help them. And so over the past 15 years or so, there's really been a push to develop some assessment tools, surveys, intake forms, questionnaires that can be used with kids and their families when they get to court to really figure out what's the need, what are the risks this child poses. Are they a risk to themselves and the community? Should they stay in a safe place before we can get them stabilized? And so an awful lot of work has been gone into the development of those tools. Now, the goal would be is that you take that the results of those tools and then you match that child with the services that would fit the child's needs best. I mean, that only makes sense. But that really hasn't happened. We've done a great job developing the tools and what we call validating them, which means scientifically they're accurate. If you give the tool to the next kid, they'll be accurate as well. But we haven't done a good job about saying, let's see, we've got 25 kids and all of them are below grade level and all of them have a substance abuse problem. Do we have programs in the community that can deal with those issues with these kids? And that's the missing link right now, is really figuring out how to get the social service providers to the table so they can say, well, here's the services we have. These match up well with the assessment questions you've got. We have literacy programs. We've got substance abuse programs. That's where states are really starting to pick up the ball now, is to figure out, we have this data. What do we do with it? How do we match these kids up now that we know who they are with the services they need? And let's monitor that. Let's manage that. Because you can't just give a kid and their family a referral list and say, well, you need to go to this counselor and that school and this doctor, and good luck with that. You actually have to go through the process with these families, who are often very unstable and don't have transportation. They themselves, the parents themselves, may share some of the problems that the child has in terms of substance abuse or literacy issues. And so you really have to go through the process with them. And when you do that and you can connect them to those services and make sure that they're implemented with fidelity, that's when you get some real success stories on the other end.
And are there any examples of some innovations in that area that you want to highlight, or is it just sort of an emerging trend right now?
It is an emerging trend, and I think there's a few jurisdictions that are starting to do a really good job with this. One of them actually is in Ohio, in Lucas County, Ohio. NCJJ had been working with the juvenile court there to develop what we call a case management system for their probation department. And what this system is all about is starting when the child comes in, doing an assessment. And in Ohio, they use something called the OYAS, which is a validated tool that came out of the University of Cincinnati. Dr. Ed Latessa and his group put that together. So they get that assessment tool. They get the results of it. And then we taught probation how to look at those assessment findings and say, okay, what does this mean? We need to create a plan for this child so that when they go to receive services or they go to placement at a state facility, they're getting what they need wherever they're at. So they're a grade level behind, they need anger management, they're diabetic, they need medication, whatever it is. We taught them, you got to create a plan, and then you have to monitor it. You know, every couple weeks, every month, check in on that child and see, are they meeting their benchmarks for their education, for their health, for their substance abuse, whatever it is. Because when the term ends, whatever term it was, let's say the child was sent to a state placement for 2 months. When that two-month period ends, the judge needs to know that this child is better off 2 months later than he was when they were sent away. And so this whole case management system allows the folks in Lucas County to keep track and to talk with the placement people and figure out, where is this child? And then, of course, once the child's ready to be released, there has to be some kind of aftercare, reentry, step-down type of process so the child can reintegrate back into their school, back into their family, back into their community. And so this case management process in Lucas County also helped probation learn how to do that piece. So right now, Lucas County has been implementing this for about 4 to 6 months. And in Ohio, as you know, it's a system we call bifurcated. It's split into two. Once a child is adjudicated delinquent, they're sent to a state facility often that's run by the Department of Public Welfare, not by the juvenile court. And so that child is not being monitored by court probation folks, and when that child's ready to be released, they're actually released through what's called a parole authority. So this whole case management system will connect probation to the kid throughout their stay, where in the past they were disconnected. And the only time the probation officer or judge would know what was going on in Ohio, in Lucas County, is the child would be released and maybe rearrested. and all of a sudden, appearing before a judge that says, I thought that you were at XYZ placement facility. Oh, well, I was released a couple weeks ago. So the case management process is hopefully really connecting the dots between the systems so that this child doesn't fall through the cracks and everybody knows what's going on, where they're at, and making sure they're meeting their benchmarks in order to have the kind of outcomes we want. So Lucas County would be a really good example of a place where it's starting to work.
Okay. And talk, you know, when we're talking about reform on state and system levels, what you're talking about, connecting youth appropriately to treatment that's going to be meaningful for them, is extremely important. I know other states, though, are looking at different kinds of reform efforts in conjunction with that, such as legislative measures.
Sure.
Because of the economy and the federal budget, different practices or practices like closing down institutions. Maybe you can sort of talk about some of those things that are happening as well.
Sure. I mean, at the federal level, we have the Juvenile Justice Delinquency and Prevention Act, and that act is up for reauthorization. It comes up every few years. It's up for reauthorization now, and it, because of other pressing issues in Washington, we're not very optimistic it's going to be passed. But that is the federal legislation that really holds states accountable for four core protections, core requirements, with regard to juvenile justice. And unlike the adult system, the adult criminal justice system, there really aren't federal requirements that hold states accountable for the way they deal with their juvenile delinquent population. So this JJDPA, as we call it, is pretty much all we've got. One of the core requirements is ensuring that there's not disproportionate minority contact. It used to be disproportionate minority confinement, which meant that if you have a population of 50 kids and 49 of the kids are white and one child is black, if they all commit the same offense, there better be a proportionate mix of kids being sent into juvenile justice and not just that one minority kid. And you look at the data over and over and you just see this overrepresentation of minority kids in the system at the confinement phase, so in the juvenile correction setting. Well, disproportionate minority contact, the reason the name was changed is that we recognize through the research that it happens much earlier downstream in the process or upstream in the process, at the point of in school, for example. There's a fight that breaks out, three minority kids, five majority kids, and the minority kids are the ones that get sent off by the police oftentimes. And so that core protection in the JJDPA is meant to help states really pay attention to the way they're imposing law and sanction against kids in their local jurisdictions in a fair way that doesn't violate civil rights. That is definitely a trend in terms of the states trying to do a better job. And actually, just recently, in October, the U.S. Departments of Justice and Education got together in Washington with their Office of Civil Rights. Both of them have an Office of Civil Rights. And they agreed that they had to start working together more proactively to keep schools from what they call the school-to-prison pipeline, just flooding the courts with kids for suspensions and expulsions, and the disproportionate number of minority kids going through that pipeline, if you will. So there's a whole new emphasis on that. There's a new federal data collection aimed to reduce it, and civil rights laws are going to be used at the federal level and within the states to hold schools accountable if they're taking the easy way out and simply saying, you're expelled, you're suspended, for very minor things that, you know, when you and I were back in school, we would have been, you know, sent to write 50 sentences on the board or something.
Right. We actually have a show next week on this very issue.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good. So from a legal, a legislative, and policy point of view, you're seeing a lot of states now start to beef up their law regarding this because they don't want to be embroiled in a civil rights lawsuit with the U.S. Department of Justice, who's now getting really serious about this.
Well, that was, I think that was one of the four you were talking about.
Right.
Correct.
Right.
Do you want to briefly go mention the other three? So, because I think it's probably interesting to
sure.
people. Okay.
Sure. Absolutely. The other ones are youth placing youth in adult jails. And so it's called the jail removal protection. And this is one of the reasons that NCJJ also stood up against the Scared Straight programming, is that it's illegal to have youth in the same physical space as an adult offender. And it's illegal under the 1980 version of the JJDPA. And some of the reasons why, I mean, some of it seems like common sense, but there's been research that's shown that youth placed in these jails are at risk of physical and sexual assault by coercive adults. And sometimes the line between adult and juvenile is obviously very, very thin, right? In the state of New York, you're considered an adult over mm-hmm. the age of 16 for the purpose of juvenile justice. So maybe you're in a situation where a 16-year-old and an 18-year-old are in lockup, technically adult and juvenile, but from a social point of view, you could see how maybe there could be some kind of relationship thing going on there. So that's one reason. It's also, kids tend to have the highest suicide rate of all inmates in jails, and kids are much more likely, almost 40 times more likely, to commit suicide in an adult jail than in a juvenile facility. And so all kinds of organizations have come out for supporting the fact that we should not have kids in adult lockups. One of the problems you see, like in Wyoming is a state that has really never been in compliance with any of these core protections in the JJDPA for various reasons. One of the problems you see with them is that they're such a rural state that they'll have a kid that, let's say, they are arrested for drinking and driving. Well, there's not a juvenile magistrate within 100 miles. So rather than delay justice for that kid by waiting 6 months till they can have a judge come in, they'll prosecute the child in the adult system there. And then the child ends up being in the adult jail and everything goes on. And so the data from Wyoming shows all these kids are being tried as adults. So, you know, that's kind of, we say at NCJJ, juvenile justice is local. And that's just one more example of what that means. It's very difficult to take the federal mandates, the federal laws, and predict that that's exactly the way it's going to play out at the local level. It just simply doesn't work that way. So that would be one of the other core protections that we really hope is strengthened through the reauthorization of JJDPA once it goes through. Another one is the deinstitutionalization of status offenders, and we touched upon this a little bit earlier. The JJDPA protects kids who have been found delinquent on a status offense, which again is an offense merely because of their age. It's not an act that's illegal on its own, so it's being truant from school, it's underage drinking, it's smoking cigarettes, it's running away from home. The JJDPA does not allow states to use lockup, detention, corrections for kids who are engaging in those behaviors. Now, what happens is that states are very creative, judges are very creative, and oftentimes they think they have the best interest of the child in mind. There's not a judge out there, I hope, who would ever use incarceration willy-nilly. But there are judges and states who feel as though you're protecting the child from an unsafe situation at home. Maybe it's a girl who's run away and you're afraid of sexual assault with a boyfriend. Maybe she's a victim of domestic violence that you know about. So you think, well, it's smarter to put that girl in jail. Well, no, it's really not. And the research clearly shows that kids that are thrown into a jail setting, especially non-serious offenders, it not only lowers their self-esteem and makes them feel like they've really done something bad, and in the case of the girl, she's run away from sexual assault, that she hasn't done anything wrong. So not only does it make them feel guilty, but it creates associations between them and truly delinquent kids. And sometimes in rural jurisdiction, again, adult offenders who are just down the hall, they're physically separated, but they're within proximity. So the deinstitutionalization of status offenders is another core requirement that, again, you know, we are hoping that in the passage of JJDPA, more and more states start to strengthen the way they deal with those kids.
Okay. Are there other, did you want to cover the fourth one? I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's fine.
Okay. Speaking about like deinstitutionalization, and I just wanted to make sure there weren't other sort of like legislative or other measures states are taking that you wanted to talk about for reform efforts. I know states are trying to incentivize local jurisdictions not to, you know, to send kids to prisons.
Sure.
And they are also looking at legislative strategies to do that, as well as other means to perhaps change ages of jurisdictions, as well as I know in Ohio here we're looking at, you know, how to address mandatory sentencing. So I don't if there's something you can sort of share with our listeners and our public policymakers about considerations in those areas.
Well, I mean, I think the age of jurisdiction is a critical question. And New York and North Carolina are you know, two of our outlier states right now in terms of that. And North Carolina was really working hard to change the age of jurisdiction. And I think, they've run into some roadblocks they didn't anticipate. In New York, the age of jurisdiction is 16. And so for any child that commits an offense of any type at 16 years in one day, they're going to be treated as an adult. And, I mean, one of the issues with that, I mean, the biggest issue is really that we can no longer just look at the calendar year, a birthday year, to understand what is appropriate for a young person in terms of them becoming an adult, a whole person. It's not as simple as, well, they're 18 now, they're old enough to leave home and leave high school, they're old enough to vote, they're old enough to go into the military. I mean, the adolescent brain research for the past 15 years has clearly shown us that our brains don't stop growing until we're in our middle 20s, you know, 24, 25 years old. And the reason that's important is that when you start to take a child who's already got some problems, they're coming to the attention of the juvenile justice system. If it's not for a minor offense or it's for a repeat offense, chances are this kid has got some issues. And so here you are trying to work through the issues with a child who still has 6, 7, 8, 9 years of development of their brain, of their ability to think, their ability to control their emotions, their ability to connect experiences, to form meaningful relationships. And so you put them in these situations that you think, well, this will fix them. Here's 6 months, here's 3 months. And yet you're trying to fix something that hasn't even finished cooking yet, so to speak. And so I think a lot of the states are starting to understand that, number one, it's not working, because what we're doing with these kids is not sensitive to the fact that their brains are not developed fully yet. Number two, when it doesn't work, that means they come back, and we're wasting an awful lot of money. And when we're wasting the money, that means the community is potentially unsafe, because this child's being released back to an unstable family environment or whatever. We think we solved the problem, and we actually haven't. And so states are, you know, we have to get smarter about this. We just have to get smarter. And I think the legislation is really starting to help support that awareness by raising the age, by incentivizing the use of evidence-based programs, and by restricting the number of kids who are actually put into an incarcerated situation. I mean, fortunately, from our point of view, juvenile detention centers and placement facilities are really shutting down left and right. And it's a hard issue for the workers there, many of whom are unionized. It's a big issue in Illinois. But you have to do, at the end of the day, you're in the business to help the kids. And if that means that someone is is not going to be able to work somewhere anymore because you don't need that jail anymore, then that's what it means. You know, these are hard choices that everybody has to come to the table with some willingness that the goal is to make things better. There is a goal in mind. It's not just to churn the business, churn the door, churn the kids through. There's a goal.
Well, I wanted to remind our listeners, if they do have a question that they want to ask on air, that number is 347-994-1149, and to press the number 1 on your keypad. What you're talking about now, we have a question in our chat room that I think goes kind of hand in hand about jurisdictions that may be trying to do things and sort of the struggles that go along with that. But our question from Angela is, are there examples of a jurisdiction who's tried scared straight tactics but have since employed different reform efforts, and what were the difference in results, and were there any hurdles they had to overcome to shift the use of programs and practices?
You know, Scared Straight never really took hold in a pervasive way at like a state level, the same way that boot camps did, for example. And so there really isn't any comparative research data between a Scared Straight program in a state versus then them implementing some evidence-based practices and then them comparing the results. There are quite a few studies that have been done, a lot in the state of Florida, which for a long time was the highest user of boot camps. And now it's hard to find boot camps called boot camps nowadays, but there are plenty of these training schools, as they call them. A lot of them are run by religious organizations and nonprofit groups. And there's still quite a few in Florida. And the studies in Florida, one was a National Institute of Justice study. The other one was from one of the universities down there. But the studies in Florida clearly showed that when the kids were in those boot camp-type settings, the rate of calls to 911 from the boot camp setting were just through the roof, basically, as compared to a normal population in the same community. So there was a lot of escalation of behavior between the staff in those facilities and the kids in those facilities, and between kids in each of those facilities. One of the issues with the boot camps is that sometimes kids in the foster care system, so those are kids who come from families where there's a child abuse and neglect issue, the child has been removed, and sometimes there aren't foster homes that really can, you know, a parent can take on the kid. So the kid goes to what's called a group home or a congregate care home. These are run similarly in some places, not all of them, but to a boot camp type of situation. And so when you have that go on, you've got these foster kids who have witnessed violence, who have been abused themselves, mixed in with delinquents who might not even be serious delinquents. You can imagine just some of the explosive issues that might come up with teasing each other and pushing each other around. So that's one of the findings. The other findings in Florida between the boot camps and transitioning to more evidence-based programming is that when kids came out of the boot camp situation, they kind of just vanished. There was nothing to connect them back to their families and communities and schools. And so the gains they had made in the boot camp, let's say, you know, they gained a grade level, because that is one of the outcomes of being in a secure setting like that. You focus on your academics. Most kids usually improve their academics in those settings. But then when they came out, they completely failed out again. Versus a child who was in a setting in the community in Florida where there was some probation management going on. When the child was done with their term of probation, they were reintegrated back into the school. Those kids did much better because there was a continuum of care between the treatment environment they were in and the school and family environment they reintegrated into. So I'd say Florida, with the boot camps transitioning to evidence-based practice, that would be the state that has done the most research and has the most to talk about in terms of comparative results between using a practice that really doesn't work that well to a more evidence-based practice.
Well, I think that's really helpful to hear. I mean, just to exemplify what differences we're talking about and how. Before that question was posed, you were talking about some of the struggles. I mean, we all want to do the right thing for youth, that I should say some challenges that states are undergoing when moving in that direction of closing institutions and trying legislative reform. Are there sort of recommendations you have for them about considerations as you're undergoing this, things to maybe try to have in place in advance, any missteps of other states that we can learn from?
Well, I think that's a great question. I mean, there's always a rush to the answer and to the solution, and you can't blame people for wanting to get there quicker. But one of the biggest problems we see is latching on to a program that you read about somewhere and saying, well, this is an evidence-based program. I'm going to buy this program, and they usually come with a cost. I'm going to implement it where I'm at, and it's going to work. And it's a mistake because your kids in your jurisdiction come from a unique context of their family, their community, the schools, the environment of the place where you're at. I mean, we all have unique communities. And so you have to really understand what are the unique needs and strengths of these kids and these families in my community before you go shopping for a program that's going to address the needs. So that's number one, is you've got to, the jurisdictions need to know who their population is and really understand the strengths and needs. The second piece is that you may not need one of the off-the-shelf evidence-based programs to get the results you want. And the reason I say that is that oftentimes we overlook the resources in our own backyard to be able to help kids and families with the things they need. It could be a jurisdiction has a huge problem with kids who are truant. And maybe once they do an assessment to really figure out what's going on with these kids, what are the issues, maybe they find out that the city cut a bus route that used to go by this neighborhood that has a bunch of kids in it. Or maybe they find out that the school changed its hours of operation and parents can't get the kids there anymore. There are local solutions to some of these problems that, again, the jurisdictions really need to dig into before they jump to grab a program and implement it. Because it doesn't matter how good a program is. If it's not right for the population you're trying to work with, it's not going to work. It's like giving someone the antibiotics for the flu. For a virus, it will not work. And so if we could get more jurisdictions to kind of take ownership of their data, their information, sit down as a team, probation, judges, teachers, say, who are our kids? Let's look at our census data, our school data, you know, the kids coming through the court. Who are these kids? What do their families look like? Let's talk to some of these folks. And then from there, you can figure out what resources do we have in the community that can help them out. If you get to a place where you've exhausted your resources and you say, we can't do this on our own, we have to have some outside expertise, then you start looking at what are those programs out there we could bring in that might be able to help us. But they all come with a cost, and you have to be willing to train your staff, to implement with fidelity, which means to the letter, and to collect data on the outcomes and analyze it to make sure it really is producing the results that you expected. Otherwise, you're just wasting your money.
Well, you know, you mentioned data, and probably everyone cringes when they hear that, right?
I know.
But it's like you're talking about, it's extremely important. First of all, we know who's in our community and what outcomes are. Mm-hmm. And so for juvenile justice stakeholders that are listening in courts and programs, I mean, you mentioned, you know, looking at census and things like that. Do you have smaller ways that jurisdictions can begin to collect data to find out the reality of their community?
Absolutely. I mean, the first thing people need to do is talk to each other. And the people who know the most about the kids in the community are the people who work with those kids. So that means the frontline workers in every social service agency in the town. So the school teachers, the probation officers, the child support enforcement people, everybody who touches the lives of those kids, they might not be administrators, they might not be managers, but they know who the kids are. And so get your staff together, have a meeting, a collaborative meeting, where you call people together and say, you know, we're concerned about some things that we see in our system, and we wanted to talk with you about what you see. Are these, you know, the same kids? Are we talking about the same kids? So a simple, easy, non-technical first step is to get a group together, a collaborative group together, and judges are really good at convening these groups. I mean, a judge calls and you say, yes, I'll be there, right? So I really encourage the judges to reach out to the community leaders, sit down, and start to have the conversation. Once you get people together talking about it, you realize that they have the answers a lot of times to the problems that you've got. And they'll say, well, I know about this. There's this grant that this school has, and I think they have someone collecting this data. I wonder if we could look at that data. But you'll never know that if you don't forge those relationships. So that's how it starts, is simply asking the questions about who are these kids, what do they need, how can we as a community help them, and then bringing people together to try and find some shared solutions. When you say data, you're just talking about knowledge and information. That's all it is, and it comes in all kinds of forms, from surveys to conversations to going to the local park with your own eye and seeing what's going on there and saying, huh, it looks like there's a lot of pushing and shoving, girls are being harassed, there's litter all over, the kids are drinking. That's data, too. That's observation. Those sorts of, all of that stuff needs to be brought together in small community groups. And you start talking about it. What is it? What does our community look like? What do we think? And people know more than they think. They really know more than they think, and they actually are collecting data all the time. They just don't see it that way. It's just their routine part of their work. So looking at it with a little different lens and asking a question before jumping to the solution, it just saves you so much heartache and so much hard work, because then you can be really planful about how are we going to approach this in a way that we can feel confident that we're really addressing the needs and valuing the strengths, which are often overlooked, that our kids and our families have.
Are there other resources that you recommend for states or systems that want to learn more about juvenile justice reform or evidence-based practices? You already mentioned one.
Sure.
I thought you might have a list.
Sure.
That you recommend.
Yeah, I would say to go onto the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention website, ojjdp.gov. I mean, that's a really good central clearinghouse that can link you into federal, state, local resources, from ways to get funding for programming to descriptions of programs, to research papers. There's webinars on there where you can click on there and learn more about particular topics. And I'd also say at the local level, jurisdictions really need to utilize and hold responsible their land-grant universities who are required to give back, and really tie those folks in and say, look, we need help. You've got psychologists and child development experts and all these people here. You need to help us figure out some of this and be partners at the table with us. And that then also goes down to the local level, where you engage the local high schools. And you use the social science class and the computer class. You help the kids help engage in the problem solving. If you need to get a website out for kids in your community to get more information about, you know, clean and sober activities on graduation, go to the local high school and say, hey, you guys have a little website class here. Would your class be interested in working with the city on putting this together? You know, we look around our office for the solutions. We have to look into the community. That's where the problems are. That's where the solutions are. So I really encourage people, beyond looking at all the websites and federal resources, to just look around their community and don't be afraid to say, hey, we need some help, and you know, we'd like your perspective on this to see if you can help us provide a solution.
Okay, well, we're almost out of time, so I want to know if you have any final thoughts or if there are other projects of NCJJ you'd like to highlight for people.
Well, I mean, I think in the final analysis, you know, juvenile justice is one of those enterprises that the worse the problem gets, the more money is thrown at it. You know, more police and more jails, and that's really not the right approach. There's no point in building a bigger system for kids who shouldn't be there in the first place. If it was a place you wanted your kids to be raised, you'd send them there instead of school. And so we really need to start focusing more and more on supporting families and communities early on so that kids don't end up finding the juvenile justice system as the only place they can go to get a roof over their head and something to eat and probably a bad outcome long term if they're you know, put in prison for a long time. We just have to start putting money in the front end of the system to prevent those kinds of outcomes. And that means supporting the parents, too, because the parents of the serious delinquent kids, they were delinquents. And they also have probably long histories with substance abuse, mental health issues, family violence, abuse and neglect. And they're simply repeating the patterns. Most kids are not serious delinquents. 85% of all juvenile delinquency is petty theft, and it's, you know, middle-class white kids that are shoplifting in malls. It's not a violent, gun-toting, gangbanger type of thing. That's not what juvenile crime in the United States looks like. But for that 15% of kids that are serious offenders who are dying out there and hurting each other, those families and those kids, those communities, they need our support at the beginning. It's not really going to help too much once they're 16, 17, 18 and have already been in 10 different placements, they're removed from their parents. We have to start sooner. So that's what I'd like to say is we just need to put our money into the prevention end and stem the tide of these problems that are quite preventable, really, on the back end.
Well, thank you, Trish, for taking the time to be on today's show. I know you're not feeling it 100% completely, and I also want to thank the listeners for tuning in. I'd also like to thank Anta, who's behind the scenes answering calls. This show will be available on demand at blogtalkradio.com/spotlightonyouth. We have two shows next week. The first will be Tuesday, March 8th. Judge Kim Brown from the Franklin County Court of Common Pleas and Sarah Beal from the Ohio Poverty Law Center talking about dismantling the school-to-prison pipeline in Ohio, which we mentioned on this show. The second show will be a follow-up to an earlier episode on the Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative. Next Friday, which will be March 11th, we'll have three guests from New Jersey JDAI's First Model State Program discussing their experiences working collaboratively to implement JDAI, including a judge and prosecutor who have been extremely involved in the effort in their local communities. So to stay informed about these and other upcoming shows, you can either follow us here at Blog Talk Radio or visit the Children's Law Center's website at www.childrenslawky.org. Take care and see you next time on Spotlight on Youth. Thanks, Trish, again.
You bet.